WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org. This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work offers a one-year advanced standing option for students with a bachelor's degree in social work that builds on prior training and connects students with expert faculty and 5 specialized pathways. Apply by February 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future.
Talking seals, ancient sharks, dancing seahorse couples all seem imaginary, but I promise they're real. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. In the new book, Vanishing Treasures, author Catherine Rundle weaves the tales of these land, sea, and air creatures into a fantastical narrative while also bringing the dangers they face to the forefront. The book dives into why humans should care, and if we don't, why we risk ceasing to care about ourselves. I sat down with Catherine Rundle to talk about her book and what animals reveal about our fears, our desires, even our anxieties. Here's Catherine.
One of the things that we can find when we look at the ways that we have interacted with, adored, cherished, destroyed, and in many ways just absolutely decimated the animal population of the world, it tells us a lot about that which is glorious about humanity, our capacity for enchantment and delight and knowledge, but also our staggering capacity for destruction and for taking the stance that the world is ours to do with what we will, which is the worst lie we've ever told, a lie with the power to kill us all.
How can learning about animals help us learn about ourselves?
So I think there would be multiple ways. You could, if you wanted to be in some ways like a sort of Renaissance scholar, you could read the animal kingdom for knowledge about what it is to exist. So for instance, you could look at lemurs which move in matriarchal societies, and when one of the male lemurs is getting a little bit aggressive, the female lemurs will slap the male lemur. But also, more gloriously, when they want to feel safe or to bond, they form what's called a lemur ball, a great sort of cascade of lemurs, and they press their hearts against each other's. And the ball can be as big as, you know, a bicycle wheel. So, you know, you could look at that and think, well, one must find a lemur ball of one's own.
So explain the title for us, A Bestiary of Extraordinary Endangered Creatures. What are bestiaries?
You would find bestiaries in, say, medieval English manuscripts, and they would be collections of real-life animals, although if you go back far enough, often a dragon will sneak in there as well. They were ways of delineating the world, ways of offering up knowledge. And so this, in some ways, is a modern bestiary in that it offers the readers a sense of the staggering beauty and strangeness of the living world.
So why write a bestiary now?
Well, as you know, we live in a moment in which we are more in peril than we have ever been. And we have already lost between 50 and 70% of wildlife. Already the erosion of what, for instance, our grandparents' landscape would have looked like is different from ours. And I guess I wanted to ask with this bestiary for people to pay attention to the wit, the glory of the living world, and to offer it not just their love, but their furious, iron-willed, active political engagement.
You open your chapter on Greenland sharks by referencing Shakespeare's writing about the bubonic plague in the early 1600s. And you mentioned that a then 100-year-old shark swam unbothered at the same time, and that it's still alive today. How can a shark be this old
Right. So this is an extraordinary thing about Greenland sharks. We've just recently were able to find a way to test the crystallines in a shark's eye, which allows us to determine their age. And we found a shark that appears to be aged somewhere between 272 and 512 years. And
Wow.
because size is thought to be quite a good indicator of age, this was a medium-sized shark. They, in fact, can grow up to 7 meters long. So it seems very reasonable to assume that there are sharks which are swimming now, right now, through their sixth century.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you write, quote, "For thousands of years, Greenland sharks have swum in silence as above ground the world has burned, rebuilt, burned again." And this strikes you as hopeful, Catherine. How so?
Yes, I find in a moment of erosion and attrition, the idea of endurance beautiful and admirable. The idea that we have been up here creating both beauty and chaos, and through it all, very steadily and very slowly, this beautiful, apparently extremely smelly shark has been swimming.
You've got a chapter on giraffes. I want to start with this line, quote, "There is something in giraffes that unhinges us in our delight." What do you think it is?
So I guess giraffes are often thought of as being, a sort of creature of parts, the camel leopard, we used to call it, a sort of wild hybrid, like a sort of mythical chimera. And I love the idea that there is something about giraffes that does send us a little mad when we see them. The story that I write about is when the giraffe first walked into Paris to meet the French king.
Yes.
And it was said that this giraffe was given a fleur-de-lis raincoat and bent to eat rose petals from the king's palms. And it was 1827, and 1827 Paris just went giraffe mad. You could have giraffe print dresses, giraffe cravats. There were colors brought out with giraffe belly, giraffe in exile. And my favorite thing is that women made their hairstyles to resemble the giraffe's, you would say, horns, like ossicones, and they made them so toweringly perpendicular that they would have to sit on the floors of their carriages because their hair was too high
Oh
to
my
not.
goodness. That is so cool. You write a lot too about just the way giraffes look and sort of trying to explain why it looks the way it does and why it does the things that it does and how, hospitable they are to the small. You talk about
Right.
giraffes being photographed at night with clusters of birds in their armpits, keeping them dry.
Right, exactly. A sort of symbiotic relationship whereby the birds are able to consume some of the pests that bother the giraffe, and in return, they nest inside the crook of the giraffe's, armpit, for want of a better word, during rainstorms.
Why do we get so fascinated by animals?
I think part of it must be beauty. Part of it must be strangeness and otherness, but part of it, I think, is much more basic. We are ourselves nature. We sometimes make a bid to forget that we are, but we too are animals. And we are animals, therefore, fascinated by other animals, fascinated by the living world, because we are the living world.
So you've got a list of texts for further reading at the end of the book, but there are no citations throughout the book. So it reads very much like a fantasy novel, and it's also a very quick read. Why did you decide to take that approach?
So I think I wanted it, as you say, to read as unscholarly as possible. My background is scholarly. I have a fellowship at Oxford University. I wanted the idea that you can read it like a thriller, read it like something where you are hungry for the next piece of information. And then at the back, I have the most striking text from which those facts are taken. And of course, if people want to know the exact place from where I will have found a fact or a reference, I can very easily be contacted, and I can give a full range of citations that I need.
So, Catherine, you wrote about these animals for another reason. They're endangered. What are the main factors threatening these species?
We know that the primary factor is climate change, and the other main reason is human encroachment onto wild spaces. We've created a kind of cacophony where before there was silence. And so this sort of very steady extinction, I think people often forget just how bad it is. But it is staggering, the levels to which we have lost that which we once treasured. We have lost more than half of all wild things that lived. And in the last 50 years, the world's wildlife has declined on average by around 70%.
So given a figure like that, what happens when we lose the ability to learn more about animals?
Right. So there's this colossal question. We will lose thousands and thousands of species before we understand them, before we understand both how we might be able to work in harmony with these creatures in order to help humankind, but also just to understand them in order to understand the world on which we stand, to know the creatures that we share this planet with. We know already that our knowledge, which is colossal, you know, I want to tip my hat to the staggering expertise of the scientists who I work alongside at Oxford. But also, we know, and they are always so keen to emphasize, colossal as our knowledge is, it does not begin to brush the edges of the truth. There is so much yet to learn, and we risk destroying the world before we can truly see it.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. You said that you want us to fall in love with these animals and take action. What steps do you want folks to take?
So this, I think, is an important question because there are things that can be done. Sometimes we look at this and we feel totally paralyzed. It's a vast structural problem which needs vast structural answers. It needs political engagement. So the one most important thing that you can do is vote for people who believe in the existence of climate change, who do not put people who work for oil companies on their cabinets. So that is the one thing you can do. Your vote is the most important. But then there are other things that we know that make a real difference. You can engage in politics at every possible level, not just once every however many years. You can engage at the local level. You can eat less or no meat. You can try to fly as little as is humanly possible for your world. You can decide to try to participate in a new way of living that does not require the relentless buying of new things in order to create delight. And you can protest.
Is this why you end the book with a chapter on humans?
It is. It's a story, I end on the story of the Sibylline books, which is an old, old story from, you know, at least as old as the year 177, about the idea that we only start truly treasuring and protecting something when it is very close to too late. The story is, in the way that I am using it, about the fact that it is not too late, but it is nearly too late. We are, whether we like it or not, and most of us would much rather this not be the case, we are the generation that will make the biggest difference to the future of the planet.
That's a lot of responsibility.
It is. It's a lot of responsibility, and we did not want it, but we have it. And I think the choice is whether or not we rise to it. And I think what will make us rise to it? Fury, I think, will help. Rage, a sense of justice. But I also think you will need to help you continue the fight. You will need love, because that will sustain you, a sense of joy in the world's wonders, a sense that you're not doing this because it's your homework, but because in doing it, you continue the survival of things which are so breathtakingly magnificent and new and strange.
That's Catherine Rundle, author of Vanishing Treasures, a bestiary of extraordinary endangered creatures, which is out now wherever books are sold. Thank you so much for joining us, Catherine.
Thank you. It's been such a delight.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Linnea Dominic. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Ari Mejia. Every day, Reset brings you conversations to help you better understand what's happening in our city and beyond. If you're interested in hearing more, you can check out our entire catalog of interviews at wbez.org/reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll meet again later today.
My name is Donald. I live on the southeast side of Chicago. I support WBEZ because of the balanced reporting and covering so much about an issue as opposed to just the few seconds that you may hear on most other news outlets. It matters to me to hear the story more completely